I see people who are suffering, and I see people who are struggling, and I see people who are unhappy, and I see people who are mad, and I see people who are full of stress and tension, and I want to say to them, there's no stress in the world. The world is absolutely just the way it's supposed to be. It's perfect, just as it is. And it's like getting that and understanding that, and your first temptation in that is to say, yes, but the people starving in Ethiopia, is that part of the perfection of it? Yes. Yes. And so is your desire to end it part of that perfection. It's like you don't argue with it. Everything that is, is. Everything that's ever happened to you already has. You can understand that worry, for example, is nothing more than thought. And what is there to worry about? Worry, which is a consuming thing that creates what we call stress, which is just stressful thinking. What is it? Here's a good parable for you. Everything that you worry about, give it this thought. There ain't no use worrying about the things that you don't have control over. Right? Because if you don't have control over them, there's no sense in worrying about them. That makes sense, doesn't it? So I don't worry about the things I don't have control over. Now, there ain't no sense worrying about the things you have control over. Because if you have control over them, there ain't no sense in worrying about them. Now we've covered everything that it's possible to worry about. It's all thought. It's all thought. If you don't have control over it, worry is absurd. So you're going to worry about getting old? I mean, do you have control over that in form? Do you have control over what is happening there? If you don't have control over that, then my belief is that it doesn't matter. It just doesn't make any difference. Because who I am is a consciousness that transcends all of that. What I want you to think about is, what in the world would you ever want to occupy your mind with worry about? Or anything that doesn't serve you living the life that you want to live? And understanding that you're never going to ever let anybody, any place, who doesn't have love or harmony to offer you, enter this dimension where you do all of your living. Maybe this dimension, but never this dimension. You see, if someone sends you hate and you react with hate, then you're acting at the lowest level it's possible to act at. If someone sends you hate and you react indifferently, you're sort of average. But if someone sends you hate or anger and you react with love, because that's what's inside and that's all you have to give away, because that's how you choose to use that dimension that is in back of your form or suffusing your form, then that is what you will start expecting and seeing in your world. And it becomes a way of living where you are able to go beyond. Think of the prefix in the English language that means to soar above, to go beyond, to go past. And you come up with the prefix trans, to go beyond, to soar above. And think of the suffix that means the result or the experience of. If you don't know that, it's T-I-O-N with an article, A. Shun, T-I-O-N, the result or the experience of. You have a new word there on the board, transformation. The result or the experience of going beyond your form. Leaving the boundaries that confine you here and only allowing what you want into that other dimension. And you know something? In this dimension of thought, or astral, or beyond, which is invisible, you can have all of your relationships in your life. You can meet people there where there are no limitations. You can meet every stranger that you ever meet in that dimension, no matter what they're sending out to you. Once you understand that thought, that what you think about expands. Now get this, it expands. So if you think about what is missing in your life, then that's what's going to expand. I was a therapist for many, many years up in New York and Long Island. And people would come to me and they would want to talk about their problems for an hour every week. And in the process of talking to me about their problem, they always talked about what was wrong. About how their husband was behaving this way, about how their children weren't doing what they wanted them to, about they didn't have enough money, and about the illness, and their mother was this way. And it was like their whole consciousness all the time was on what was missing, what was wrong, what was negative, what was unpleasant. That's what occupied this territory that I can't define, that is invisible in their lives. Now you have to understand that when you do that, that is going to expand in your life. And there's a reason for that. There's a very important reason for that. Because what you think about expands into action, into form. It's just a matter of bringing it from here to here. And you choose what comes in here. You create all of this. Because thought starts with you. You are the creator of thought. And therefore, you are the creator of life. And you are the very creator of what your form is going to experience. As the Sufis used to say, if you don't have a temple in your heart, you'll never find your heart in a temple. It's having it in your heart, and that comes from thought. So what you think about is profoundly important in your life. Emerson said, you become what you think about all day long. Christ said, as you think, so shall ye be. All the spiritual masters who've ever come our way have always talked about, be careful what you think, because it's going to expand into your life.
I'm just beginning to understand that what we think about is much more powerful than I'd ever given consideration to before in my life. And I'm beginning to get evidence for it. I'm beginning to see it as I look back on things. When I was a little boy, we had an Admiral television set in 1951. I was 11 years old. We were one of the few people in the neighborhood to have this little TV. I used to stay up late at night and watch The Tonight Show with Steve Allen on it. And I had this thought, and it was a very powerful thought. And the thought was that I would be on The Tonight Show. I just knew it. And I used to tell my brothers what I was going to talk about when I would be on The Tonight Show. I was only 11 or 12 years old. They were 13 and 15. And they'd say, oh, yeah, sure, you're always dreaming. You've always got... Well, I'd still stay up at night, and everybody else would go off to sleep. I'd be watching the show. I'd watch it every single night, all of his funny routines that he did and all the characters on it and everything. And I could see myself. I could picture myself sitting on the panel there and having him interview me or having him be there with me and all of that. That passed, and many, many things like that, though, in my life that I thought about. Well, the irony of ironies is that 1976, 25 years later, I'm the author of a book that is at the top of the bestseller list around the world, The Erroneous Zones. I'm invited to do The Tonight Show, and Shecky Green is the host that night. It was the very first time I ever did the show, out of 34, 35 times. I was so excited. It was like a dream come true that I was going to be on The Tonight Show. I'd already done several other big shows and all of that. This was really something big. There was a bank of phones outside the green room where you get dressed for the show. I decided to call my wife and family back home and tell them that I was going to be on and Shecky Green was going to be the host and so on. I went over to the phone, I picked up the phone, I called my wife and I was talking to her, and then on the phone next to me, in this bank of phones, Steve Allen. Steve Allen is standing there talking on the phone to his wife. And I take the phone receiver out of my hand and telling my wife, I said, you're not going to believe this, but Steve Allen is standing here right next to me. And I take the phone and reach it over so that she can hear his voice. And he's talking to his wife. And he's looking at me like, who is this crazy guy? Well, it turns out that the very first guest on the show that night was Steve Allen. After all those years, and there I was sitting there talking to him. A lot of people label a situation like that as circumstances, you know, or just coincidence, or just blind random luck or whatever. I've come to know that there's no such thing in the universe, that what you think about expands, and that if you have a thought in your mind and you stay with that thought and you know it to be true, it's just a matter of bringing it into form. And if you're willing to do that, if you're willing to bring it into form, it's going to happen for you. Nothing can stop it. Nothing can stop it. And I don't think there's anything random about it. I just don't even believe in randomness at all. I think that everything in the universe is absolutely perfect at the tiniest subatomic level and at the largest level.
I get on the elevator, and I'm on the 17th floor. I have an office on the 17th floor. And I get in the elevator, and a couple gets on the 14th floor, the elevator opens, and they're complaining about a tax audit that they just went through and how awful it was, and that they took more money of us, and they're always doing that. And I'm standing in the back of the elevator. I do this all the time. It's like I stand there, and then I really stand back here. Who I really am stand back here, so I watch myself. It's like when you talk to yourself. That's two people, isn't it? You talking to yourself. And then it's like, then you watch these other men. I'm standing there watching. They're looking at my form, and I'm back there looking at the whole scene. I do this all the time. It's great. So I'm on the elevator, and this is just a couple weeks ago, and the elevator stops again on the 9th floor. And another couple gets on, and I'm standing in the back watching the whole scene. It's a wonderful place to get to, where you just sort of observe life, and you're not in conflict with it, and you sort of surrender to it. You know it's all going to work, and everything's going to be positive, and so on. It was August, and they're complaining about how hot it is in August. And, it's just, God, it's been ghastly. This whole time, another day, we've got to go out in this heat. And I'm standing listening to this, and there's the audit over here, and there's the heat over here. And we get to the 4th floor, and another couple gets on. And they're complaining about how many stops the elevator's making today. It's true. So they're like, oh, damn elevator, it's always stopping. And it's like, so I'm standing in the back watching this whole scene playing out in front of me, thinking to myself, I never do this. I used to do this, but I never do this anymore. And you may say, well, what is it that you don't do? What I don't do is ever find it possible for myself to think about things that I don't like, or that are missing, or that are miserable, or that I find distasteful, because I somehow have got in my consciousness an understanding that when you do that, that's what expands in your life, and that really successful people only see things working out. And they understand that, they get that, they hold on to that, and they get that picture of it. Like, I can't get a picture before going out to speak of an audience who's not going to like me. Because I know that's going to expand. And I'll walk out and go, and that'll be the end of it. All right, it'll be done. I know that it's going to be great, and it's going to be terrific, it's going to be fun. If I keep that consciousness inside of me, that I'll expand that into action. So now you have to do is look at all of the stuff that's going on in your life. And how much of it is a result of you'll see it when you believe it. Of seeing what you're thinking about. Now, when my kids go to sleep at night, I never tell them if they got a little sniffle, this is going to be worse tomorrow, you're going to have to take off school. I wouldn't want to program them with anything like that. I always tell them how strong they are, how terrific they are. This thing's going to be gone in the morning, and you'll be off to school, and it's going to be great. I want them to be able to expand into form thought that they want, rather than the other way around. And people who are chronic complainers never seem to be able to get past that, and everything that they think about keeps coming up, and the tragedies keep multiplying, and the horrible things keep coming into their lives, and it's like that becomes a part of your consciousness. In an energy system where thought is the energy or the current, what you think about expands into action. It's like getting old. You know, it's like I tell people, don't let an old person move into your form. Don't let an old person in. Don't let an old person move in. The age of your form isn't who you are. Who you are is thought, and thought is ageless. You can't age thought. Age is universal and eternal. It goes forever. It's what the universe is. So you don't let that person who walks slow and talks slow and thinks slow, you don't let that person in.
Reading the literature of the East, particularly in preparation for my book, You'll See It When You Believe It, I would find that over and over, I would see references to this thing called the observer. I'd say, the observer. And one particular group of people would have written about it, and then it would show up in Buddhism, and it would show up in Hinduism, and it would show up in practice of Zen and in Kundalini. And it just kept showing up, this observer, the observer. And I wasn't quite sure what it was, what it meant. And then I began to realize that it's something I've done all my life, only they were just putting it into words. It's really a technique that I find myself using over and over again. The best way to think of it is, like Shakespeare said, the whole world is a stage, and we are all but actors on that stage. When you start to look at it that way, you begin to see yourself as having a lot of roles to play. And they really are roles. And we're all out there playing these roles. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm not authentic at all. I'm not talking about authenticity. Each one of these things are very real, but they are still roles that we're playing. So what you have to do is sort of remind yourself that you're doing that and not take all of this whole stage so seriously and make it so dramatic and so significant and important. It's like lightening you up a little bit. And the observer is like whoever this guardian angel or this invisible person is. You can sort of catch yourself whenever you find yourself getting out of control or getting mad at the fact that there's a delay at the airport or that the traffic isn't going the way you want it to. That invisible guardian angel, that eye that can be in back of you, can put the skids on that right away. That person can say, I'm watching you. I'm watching your form. You know, Lily Tomlin had a great line. She said, how come when you talk to God, it's called praying? But when God talks to you, it's called schizophrenia, you know? But that God talking to you can be that invisible part of you. Then you start connecting to that. And then I find myself, wherever I am in my life, whatever I'm doing, in back of myself, on my shoulder or whatever, and reminding me, how should you react to this? Send love here. On an airplane not too long ago, there was a little lady about 4'10", and she had gotten on the plane first, and she got about halfway down the aisle, and she couldn't get her stuff. She had a handbag, and so she couldn't reach the upper bin. She was standing on the seat and all this, and I was right behind her. All of the people in back of me were all grumbling about this lady and how rude she was being and how terrible and how can you behave this way? And if you're going to take so long, then you should have got on last. It's like their observer was telling them to act nasty or they weren't paying attention to that. And I was saying, what can I do here? Where there was a time when I would have thought, get out of the way, lady. Come on, I got to get to my seat. And you're holding up everybody. And I didn't do that. I stopped. I said, here, you know, I'm 6'1". I can do this for you. And I put that up and I did this. And I said, here, have a nice day. And I had a book with me and I signed it and I gave it to her. And she was happy. And that was the observer. In order to make this technique work for you, and all of us have that capacity to do it, as I've just illustrated, what you have to do is first become aware of what you're doing to yourself. That if you're into that hurry up, type A, got to get there fast, everything has got to get done yesterday kind of mentality, then there's still something that is making you do that. It may be very instantaneous or what some people would call subconscious, which I don't like to call it that because if it's below your consciousness, then you're not aware of it anyway. So, you know, why call it that? And that's just a cop out. It's an instantaneous reaction through a lot of training to how you have to live your life. So what you do is you catch yourself in the moments like I just described on the airplane, or in any moment when you find yourself reacting in a way that you know isn't good for you, isn't working for you, isn't healthy. As soon as you see that, you don't need a doctor to tell you that worrying a lot about a lot of things is going to create an ulcer for you. It's going to make you feel tight inside. Your body reacts to thoughts. And the thought of, I've got to get there fast, and I've got to get around this traffic, and it shouldn't be this way, and I've got to get that done, gives you cramps. You notice that your heart, your pulse rate is going much faster, or you're twitching, or you're sweating. Those are all signals to you. Don't do that. I mean, you don't have to go to a physician and go to therapy to find that out. Stop doing that. Look in the mirror if you're all flushed and bloated and sick or gulping down antacids. Whatever it is, in order for you to get through your days, you know that that isn't working for you, that your life isn't. So get an observer and get that observer to catch you and say, wait a minute, I'm your buddy. That's who I am. I'm with you. I'm going to get in harmony with that part of me. And I'm going to allow that observer to do more of the directing and watch out for the roles that I'm playing. And whatever role I'm playing that isn't working and providing me with the joy and the success and the happiness that I really believe I'm entitled to, I'm going to have that observer catch me at that and stop me from behaving in that way. It really is a tool to help you to be more realistic, more tuned in life. For me, it is a reminder that there's much grander things than what I've just become accustomed to. I'll give you an example on the tennis court. My doubles partner made a bad shot, and he screamed something out, called himself a name. He said, ah, you jerk, you dummy. He was talking to himself. And I stopped and I said, Lenny, I really don't appreciate it When somebody calls my partner a jerk and a dummy, I said, who was that? Who was doing that? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, whoever it is that's calling my partner a jerk and a dummy, I'd like you to get in touch with him and remind him that he's a beautiful guy and he just didn't hit the shot the way he wanted to. I'd like you to tell that person that. It's like a reminder that when you call yourself a name, you know, you got two people going here. You got the person who's the recipient, the jerk, and you got the person doing the calling. Well, you want to get those two in balance. You want to get those two in harmony. You want that person, whoever that is saying, you jerk, to say, you're allowed to make an error in tennis. You have to do it. Nobody goes through a whole match without making errors. And that it's okay, and that you forgive yourself, and you're kind to yourself. And then the recipient of that is in balance, so that those two people, quote, or those two parts of you are in harmony. Because if the part of you that's calling you a jerk, if the recipient of that begins to believe that, then you start acting on what you hear and what you believe. And pretty soon, everything that you say to yourself, if you call yourself a jerk enough, you're going to think that you're a jerk. And that's one of the problems with self-esteem. It's people who have really talked to themselves in such a way that the self and the I, which we've separated, they've become the same. And so the person who's doing the calling believes that they're a jerk, and the person who's the recipient believes it. And if they had an observer there, if that I who was doing that instead was saying, you know, you're pretty terrific. You know, you make some mistakes. All of us do, but that doesn't mean that you're bad and that you're not any good. And you get those two in harmony so that you are never calling yourself anything but what you would like to be. And the more you do that, the more that you'll be in harmony. And that's all invisible. I tell people, supposing you went to sleep and you had a dream, and in your dream you had, oh, all these different characters, and you had all of this money, and you had everything that you wanted in your dream. And then you woke up, and then you look back at your dream, and you became attached to the stuff that you had in your dream. Wait a minute, I want that. There was gold in there. There was silver. There was all of these friends. There was cars. I had a Ferrari. I gotta have that. Somebody would cart you off and put you in a rubber room and say, that was a dream. You can't be attached to that. That's just a thought that you have. That's the way you gotta view life. Instead of it being an 8-hour dream, it's an 80-year dream or a 90-year dream. And at the end of the dream, you don't want to be looking back at all of the stuff that you wish you could still have because you can't have it. You don't get any of that. So you try to detach yourself now while you're here, while you're alive, from the need to have that stuff. Instead, you just let it sort of all flow. As absurd as it would be for you to be attached to the stuff that you had in your dream, it's that absurd for you to be attached to the stuff that you're having in this dream. You have to die while you're alive. Now, that's a very hard concept for people to get. You have to experience your own death while you're alive. Let me tell you a story. It's a wonderful story. It's an old, ancient story. I'll paraphrase it. There was a hunter who lived in India, and he would go to Africa every 2 years, and he would bring back animals and prizes and things like that. Well, 1 year he took off, and he went to the jungle, and he discovered this large enclave inside the jungle. And it was filled with beautiful parrots, beautiful birds, multicolored, and they all talked. And he couldn't get over it. And he put a net out over one of the trees, and he captured one of the parrots. And he put the parrot in a cage. And he brought the parrot back to be with him in India as his pet. And he fed the parrot sunflower seeds, and he fed him rice, and he took wonderful care of him. He was very good. Kept him in the cage. 2 years went by, and he talked to the parrot every day. And he said to the parrot, I'm now going back to Africa. Is there anything you would like me to say to your friends back there in the jungle when I'm back there? The parrot said, yes. Tell them that I'm very happy in my cage. Tell them that I'm joyful and that I love being in my cage here with you. Just tell them that. The hunter went back to Africa. He went back to the place in the jungle where he had been 2 years before. And he told the story. He said, your friend that I took back has a message for you. And the message is that he is happy in his cage, that he is joyful with me, and that he has no regrets. At the instant of hearing that, a bird on one of the branches keeled over and dropped dead. Dropped dead, stiff. The hunter assumed that he was just filled with sorrow at hearing of what had happened to his friend. So he went back to India, and he told his parrot what had happened. He said, I went back and I did just as you said. And I told them all out there. And at the moment that I told it, apparently, one of the parrots was so upset that he'd missed you so much that he just dropped dead. And at the instant that that happened, the parrot in the cage keeled over dead. His legs went straight up in the air and he went stiff. The hunter was beside himself. He couldn't figure out how could this happen. And he took the dead parrot out of the cage, opened it up, and threw it out on the woodpile. The instant that the parrot landed on the woodpile, he flew up to the branch. And the hunter said, you tricked me. What is this? I thought you were dead. And the parrot said, my friend back in the jungle was sending me a message. He told me, by his actions, that in order for you to escape from your cage, you must die while you're alive. Okay, now that's an old story. That's an ancient story that's been told over the years. What does it mean? I mean, don't you see that this is a cage? The whole planet is a cage. If you can just stand back far enough and see that we're still restricted by the limitations placed on us as human beings. We're stuck here, or maybe in our homes, or in wherever we are. We're all in cages. And even though we have more room to manipulate, we may even have a whole planet, we're still sort of in cages. Now, how do you escape from the cage that you're in? You have to die while you're alive. You have to literally experience your own death. All of us have to. All of us are going to die. So why not experience it in advance and see yourself out of your body, gone, but able to look back at what's going on now, just like the dream, where you have the dream and you have everything you want, but you're able to look back at it. As you do that, you begin to see the folly, the absurdity of hanging on to anything, of being attached to anything, of needing anything, of telling yourself that I can't be happy if, from the perspective of having died, but being able to look back on it just like the dream. As soon as you can do that, as soon as you can experience yourself formless, dimensionless, form and all of the attendant things that you hang on to become irrelevant. They're not necessary any longer. You have a whole new way of living, a new way of being.